The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
This is Pat Jackson. I'm the founder and CEO of Sabal Capital Holdings.
And this is Mike Consul, and we welcome Pat to the program. We're going to be talking about investing in secondary and tertiary markets specific to real estate. I had a conversation with Pat a couple weeks ago where he made a pretty convincing argument at the time that now is a good time to be going to secondary and tertiary markets, even as we face what most people are expecting to be an economic slowdown. Already we're seeing the signs of an economic slowdown and what is likely going to be finally, after all this time, a real estate downturn of some magnitude. And this comes, though, after we have seen so much money that has flooded into the United States from foreign sources, and then, of course, domestic companies that have invested in Tier 1 markets. Bid prices of real estate up very high. A lot of that money started to spill over into secondary markets and to a lesser degree, tertiary markets. There's some trepidation around going to secondary and tertiary markets for a lot of investors. We'll talk to Pat about that over the course of this program. So Pat, thank you for joining us. I do appreciate your time. And let's begin with a definition of a secondary and tertiary market, because you know we've got our Tier 1 markets, but what population size or some other measure do you use when you're talking about or designating a market secondary or tertiary?
Well, we look at the smallest sizes, typically 25,000 population MSAs, and you know, below that you start to get into a pretty small marketplace. The secondary markets are 100 to 500,000. And so they're mid-sized cities that they have decent infrastructure, a reasonable industrial base to be able to support a population of working people. But it's not off into the hinterlands where you have to a long drive to get to the regional airport, for example. So it's it has infrastructure, it has it has a real business center, and some thriving businesses that attract the population there.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the top secondary and tertiary markets. What do you consider to be, let's start with some secondary markets, what do you consider to be some of the prime secondary markets and why?
It depends on asset class. I mean, the reality is, just to simply say, hey, this is a good market and it's a general comment, you got to ask specifics. I'll pick on, let's say, Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh has done a great job attracting a lot more diversity to their economy than they've historically been a steel focused town, and therefore it's a market that is starting to emerge with other industry, and is creating opportunities around different types of asset classes. One of them is smaller multifamily asset classes are really in demand right now in Pittsburgh. And primarily because as industry comes into that area, it's attracting workers. And typically, it's either younger or lower income workers to fill jobs. And they just need affordable places to live. When you start having people coming into the area, naturally that starts to bring in other opportunities like grocery centers or maybe it's office space just to house the new industry coming there. So it's really going to depend on how diversified the base is in some respect to what's driving the growth.
What about tertiary markets? Are there two or three you can name that you would cite as ripe markets for investment?
When you and I talked about this, I said I'm not going to pick on a state on a particular place because, the moment I say it, somebody will say, yes, but. Oh. It's going to really depend on a specific an investor. For example, if they have a unique connection to a particular market, whether it's Omaha or something like, I grew up in Omaha, therefore I have a particular connection to Omaha. you know, when we start looking at some of the smaller markets, and we speak with investors that you know, I'm talking about regional operator investors that we deal with, usually they have some kind of unique connection there. Either they're from there and they have, you know, deep connections into the market to be able to find interesting investment opportunities that otherwise are not widely marketed, and that creates opportunity for investing. Or there's something just, you know, happening in that particular market that it makes it unique. Whether it's a, you know, I mean, I'll give you a good example. You know, when Boeing moved to Charleston, South Carolina, and brought in the new manufacturing plant, that was a shot in the arm of that economy that, you know, you couldn't anticipate till it was announced. And you know, Charleston is certainly a small market relative to, you know, other markets around the country. So it's going to be so specific to to a market and to the operator and to the asset class they have an expertise that it's hard to really pick one and say, okay, you know, Charleston is a great market, although it is a great market, as an example.
There you see, you just said it.
It's
a great market. I've been there. It's a beautiful
market. It is a great market. Yeah.
It's got high housing prices. I don't know what the office market's like there, but there are certain markets that have got some, you know, there's people who talk about buzz. They say Austin, Texas has buzz.
Yes, it does, yeah.
And there's certain markets that are like that they attract young people. They have some good employers.
Sure.
And so on. So, it's clearly.
Well, you take Austin as an example. It's got some big drivers going for it. It's got the state government's house there. It's got the university there. It is it's attracting many California companies getting the heck out of this tax state and moving into Texas, for example. I mean, I think the governor at one point said that the greatest thing that ever happened was to Texas was California, and people are finding that's a great place to live, and it's got a very thriving young person population. The music scene and the social scene has really kind of created a nationwide buzz that people are now starting to pay attention to it. You know, Atlanta went through that for a long time as well, till it got really big. Where it really started, you know, being viewed as, hey, I want to go live there. And, you know, that attracts companies and headquarters. And, you know, one thing kind of builds on the other before you know it's a big market.
So maybe another way to look at this is also capital flows. If you look at the capital flows to the various markets, we've seen, during the opening, and I think you agree that the primary markets have gotten bid up. And so the money starts to spill over. So if we look at the capital flows, and I don't know whether you have these, if you look at them very closely, Pat, but that would tell us something about what kind of secondary markets are having a lot of appeal to investors. Mm-hmm. What are you seeing there?
Well, statistically, I'll give you a couple of very specific examples where, you know, we find that often some of the investments that are being made in the smaller markets are smaller investments, and you know, a lot of the money that actually went into the large into the top tier cities were typically big, high-profile investments, and that attracted, you know, international investment funds. Pick on Blackstone; everybody wants to pick on them. They need to put a lot of money to work, and they make very high-profile investments. You start getting into the smaller markets, the dynamics change. One, they're smaller investments, which makes it often harder for the larger firms to justify making a small investment because they have to do it in such a granular way. And then it also is often, it's not, because it's not going to be that large, it's usually can be viewed more as a local transaction than, you know, a New York firm investing in, you know, Austin as an example. So, we've been seeing a lot of smaller operators the smaller operators, not, you know, one asset. They may have 25 assets, but they have done an incredible job as far as being experts in that specific market. They're not looking across multiple regions. They're not even looking really, in some respects, outside that particular MSA. But in that MSA, they've created scale, and they've created an expertise that really allows them to be best in class, to be able to make investments and pick the ones that actually pick the investments, because they know the market really, really well. It is more of a small investment, but done multiple times, it actually becomes a good amount of money being put in there. And that's what we're seeing, is the local guys really seeing that while they don't have billions behind them, they do have the local advantage to find deals often before the big guys see it. And you talk about capital flowing out of the big cities into the smaller areas. That is one of the challenges they have. They have to be able to often partner with someone to be able to do that. Otherwise, they just miss out on the opportunities. And we hear that from some of our investors, is that they've invested in different funds, and the funds are coming back, basically saying, gosh, we're just not being able to get to the deals before they kind of get wrapped up, because the local guys kind of have a corner on it because they've been around there for a long time. That was my example about a moment ago, about the guy saying, I'm from Omaha, I invest in Omaha. The reason why, because he has an advantage. And it creates some real opportunity, I think, and we're paying attention to that.
So if you're not based in Omaha or some other city with opportunities, let's say you're based in Irvine, California, like Sabal Capital Partners.
Yep. Exactly.
Sabal is. How do you access deals like that? Do you partner with people on the ground?
Yep.
Talk about that a little bit. Not necessarily Sabal, but to educate people in general.
For sure. So if you go back even to when we started the company back in 2009, part of it was, we were buying distressed debt. And, buying a billion-dollar pool of distressed debt that came out of a bank that may be, across the United States is, great. You have real advantages to be able to actually buy that, because you have scale and you have expertise. But when you start actually working those individual assets out, we're not in every city in America. Even though we are a nationwide platform, we do rely on the local specialists to help us, to execute our investment strategies. So, we bought 5,000 assets at the peak, and we worked those assets out over, over 3 or 4 years, in part working with the local guys. So they had a unique perspective. They had an expertise in that specific market, and we found that to be a great business model. As we've shifted over to be more of a lender, we continue to actually look for borrowers in commercial real estate that have a specific capability in that market. What we don't want to do is be lending to a person in California for a property in Texas, and they have no connection there, and they don't really have an ability to really make one a good assessment about the property, or more importantly, operate it efficiently, because they don't know that market as well. You want to try to get as local as you can, whether you're actually lending or whether you're investing. And if you're if you're simply a capital provider, you certainly want to make sure that you're working through as much of a trusted resource as you possibly can, which is something we've done, and feel like that's been a successful business model for us.
Well, we're a really big country, particularly in terms of the number of cities we have and the number of substantial cities that we've got. So, if you're looking to find partners on the ground, there's dozens and dozens and dozens of potential cities. So you must be targeting. You must be saying, you must be narrowing these cities down to what you see as prime targets. So, and I'm not going to ask you to name them, because you've already said that you don't really like doing that. But
by naming one, I'm excluding another. And every city has something of merit. And it's not like you're picking one at the exclusion of the other. That each one, properly identified, you can find interesting investing opportunities, regardless of where it is.
So, how many are in your strike zone?
About 500.
500? That means that you've got to
We're in 46 states today. So we have offices, in Boston, and I think we have 15 people in New York, and all the way down a couple offices in Florida, and in between, and then coming across the country, Texas and Kansas City and Chicago and Portland, and then coming down Denver and probably leaving out some places. But the point is, we're trying to put people in the region to get them as close as they can be to identify who we want to do business with. And what that does is it makes you closer to the actual action of what you're trying to accomplish. And if you're sitting in Irvine, California, which we are, and that's your sole view of the world, and you're not able to actually rely on your people being closer to where it is, it's going to be pretty risky to try to make investments or make decisions, around deploying capital if you're 2,500 miles away and you're just flying in to get a tidbit. So that's why we have that coverage.
Okay, so you got a bigger footprint than I thought you had. And mm-hmm. Let's take a place like Boise, Idaho. I don't know if that's I would expect that that's one of your 500. Now, do you literally have relationships on the ground there, or do you see deals come up and then you reach out to partners to help you wrap that deal up? In other words, getting the local knowledge and relationships by creating a relationship at the time that you see the opportunity.
Yeah. Yes. So we don't have an office in Boise. We know that market. We've been in Boise before. Typically, you want to work with someone who knows Boise. Obviously, we have an office in Denver, and we have one in, I think Boise may be technically closer to Portland. So we would, we would try to make sure that we're working with somebody who understands what we're trying to do. I think in Boise it would be more of a lending relationship than it would be an investing relationship. I'll give you an example of an investment we made recently. That was in San Francisco, which of course is a large market. So I don't want to compare it to Boise, but. It's an investment where we're making equity investment in buying a building. We work with two local operators that were we had known in the past from other companies they had worked with. They had come together to start a business to focus on that. They found a property that was off market that was being settled through an estate. They were able to wrap it up, and we thought it was a very attractive and compelling investment thesis. And we backed 90% of the equity to make that deal work. And while that happens to be in San Francisco, that story plays whether it's Orlando or whether it's in Kansas City or whether it's in Cleveland. Cleveland's a great market. That's the kind of thing you want to be able to do when you're making investments, is make sure at least you have somebody either is sourcing it for you that really knows the market, but ideally they're sourcing it and they have skin in the game. And typically when you get good alignment like that, you have good results.
So let's talk a little bit more specifically about the opportunity, just in terms of how to play it. As I was saying, and I don't want to be a grave dancer, but there's a real estate downturn that's coming, whether it's in the next 12 months or 5 years. And we see some signs of it just because the economy is slowing down. And when we talked before, you had indicated that you feel as though now is a good time to be thinking in terms of providing credit, of a debt. And we're seeing this even with the institutional investors that are putting a higher quotient of debt into their portfolios. So talk about that a little bit. Did I hear you right when you said, now's a good time to
get
credit?
Yeah, you did. Sure. Yeah, most of our investments today are credit-oriented strategies. So so whether we're buying B pieces of securitizations or whether we're actually backing a whole loan, or we're actually making so it's basically a lending strategy. But the nice thing about it is you typically have you have real equity ahead of you, and and yet you're protected as first lien. So in the event that it goes wrong, you can at least go in and perfect yourself by taking control of the property. But you had an operator ahead of you. You know, that is not our lending strategy. This is not a loan to own strategy. However, you know, when you're in the equity, and things go rotten, you know, the reality is you don't have any kind of safety net for yourself. You're out. When the property goes down, your equity's blown away. And with debt, at least you can actually, you know, secure yourself. And so that's why we've been focusing on you know, this lending strategy, and you know, it's a big business for us. When you go through and look at you know, the larger markets, you know, we've been typically lending in, you know, I would say top in standard markets, so, you know, in which are all big cities. The benefit with low cap rates is that your LTVs, your loan to value relative to what the cash flow is, you know, it's means you have a lot of equity ahead of you. So it does provide us with a lot of comfort that even though values are up, there is an awful lot of equity ahead of us as the senior lender in that case. In the smaller markets, you know, cap rates are higher, and you know, often we have a lot stronger cash flows that results in that, just because we, you know, we adjust our underwriting to basically make sure that we're protecting ourselves in the event of a smaller market has less population to fill a tenant, for example, you know, rollover. So, you know, you can make adjustments to how you underwrite relative to the market size to protect yourself as a lender, whereas if you're in the equity, often you're just trying to get the deal done, and you may or may not, you know, be able to protect yourself in the event of a downturn. And I, by the way, I agree with you. We're going to have a downturn. It's inevitable. You know, life goes on. Things will, you know, the commercial real estate market is, you know, it's a cycle-driven business. It will be up and it will be down. But, you know, some companies do well when things are going great, and they fall apart when things go poorly. You know, we like to tell people, because we have our roots in distress, and we've done well when times are good, is that, you know, regardless of what is going on in the marketplace, you know, we will be a participant. We like to think that the market has a, you know, it cycles softly, but you never know. But if it doesn't, we'll shift gears and go back to our distress business investments.
So let's talk about the risks associated with that kind of, debt lending, even debt lending, let's say, in secondary and tertiary markets. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons some players don't like to do equity investing in those markets is because they say that a big anchor tenant, when they fall out,
yep,
a lot of these cities don't have a lot of big companies. They have a lot of, you know, mid-sized companies, and they have one or two big players. And if you
lose
a big player, now I'm going to have a heck of a time filling that space. So,
So
maybe that's part of the risk on the debt side as well.
It is.
Talk about that.
Well, I mean that, I don't know how you underwrite the loss of a major industry unless you knew what was happening in advance. And if, you know, that's Houston's downturn in the 90s when oil got in trouble. So, you know, you do want to look at a market and make sure that it's got some sustainable base that goes beyond a single industry. And, you know, you try to adjust for that as a lender with how much you're willing to lend. I mean, the nice thing about it is, if you you know, you can adjust your lending standards to match what you perceive as the risk. You know, you might, in, you know, one place you may be willing to give a 75% loan, and another place you may only be willing to do a 50% loan. And what you're trying to do is make, you know, real estate investment level kind of decisions relative to your debt. So we're not trying to replace the fact that we're at the end of the day at the heart of what we do, real estate investors. We're just trying to properly protect ourselves as the debt provider, so that we don't absorb downsides in the event of a major cycle down, whether it's driven by a specific industry or the overall market itself.
So talk about property type considerations, and I realize that market to market it's so different, but Let me just take a flyer on this one. Let's take retail.
Mm-hmm.
Retail is one that a lot of people are scared of. There's lots of opportunities there. If you listen to sophisticated investors, they'll say there's a lot of opportunity in retail, but you really have to know what you're doing. But for that reason alone, it's risky. And retail does seem to like it changes very quickly because consumer tastes change. And then you always got the whole dynamic with the with e-commerce and whatnot. So I throw that out as an example of where some people might see
It's the best example. It's the best example because and everyone's focused on that.
Well, what about property types in general? How do you assess property types, or how much do you take that into consideration? I would imagine quite a bit.
Yeah, quite a bit. I mean, for example, again, let's pick on retail because it seems like everybody can. You know, it is subject to a lot of changing. I'll say taste. I'm a big Amazon Prime person, so I mean, I'm a good example. I don't go to a mall. You know, I heard 10 years ago that the internet was going to put the regional malls out of business, and it may have been right. So, you know, you have to pick within retail what exactly you're talking about. Are you talking about a regional mall? That's a big bet. Or are you talking about a strip center that has nail salons and, barbershops and whatnot? You're not getting that done online. So you have to kind of pick your particular properties and a particular asset class. So, retail was a broad definition of an asset class. So you have to really look at the asset level specifically. What does it make up the tenant base? How long have they been there? What are the terms of the leases? And what is the term of your debt, for example? How well does your operator operate? How long have they been there? Do they seem to be able to have an opportunity when you have vacancy? How quickly they've been able to turn it over and refill it? I mean, we look at all that kind of thing in part to try to assess how well that operator is going to be able to weather a change in their current tenant profile. And if it's too big, or is in a market that we think doesn't have a lot of depth to it, you better be careful. I'll pick on another asset class for a minute and pick on it just to give an example. We did a loan very recently, maybe yesterday, on a self storage building in Florida, and we looked at that self storage and looked and see, okay, this is a small market, and indeed it was. And we looked at we looked at the operator's history of running that type of asset, and more importantly, we looked at the overall area and said, how many other properties are in this area to the point where in a downturn one cannibalizes the other one and they're basically fighting over the same customer base. So we got comfortable with that because we determined, they didn't have a lot of coverage in that space, in that area. So we felt like, okay, we feel good about this, especially at the LTV levels that we did. So commercial real estate, I guess, is the good thing and the bad thing is that it is so specific. People always say every deal has a story. And I think the story, you hear that and you think, it's something bad. It actually is, it's not so much bad. It's just the nuance of that deal is what makes it the opportunity to invest in it or to lend in it or not. And unlike the residential market has gotten so formulaic, this deal comes down to a human being making an investment decision about whether they want to either put their equity in or whether they want to put a loan on it. And we haven't talked about cap rates, but at the end of the day, the cap rate is the return for that for that investor around their perceived risk. And if the cap rates are in the smaller markets historically have been higher and continue to be higher, and I think that is in part to basically entice investors to be able to continue serving that marketplace to offset some of the perceived risk in this particular market.
So let's talk about the difference today, investing today in secondary or tertiary markets versus 10 or 20 years ago? And let me overlay that with a couple of themes, one of which is we see urbanization going on. Cities are, in a lot of cases, these cities, even smaller cities, are building some momentum in terms of population. And probably commercially too, just companies moving in. And then there's also been industrial real estate that's just been booming. And I've seen some of these areas around cities, you might call them, not, you wouldn't even call them edge cities, they're farther out than that, that are just booming with warehouses. So there's been some of these changes going on. So I'll throw that just into the mix because perhaps those are a couple things that you're seeing there. But when you think back 10 or 20 years ago versus today, what has changed in the real estate investing world in those markets?
Well, population, I guess, if nothing else. I mean, it comes to mind Atlanta. 20 years ago, maybe a little bit longer than that, 30 years ago, if you went outside of the 285 corridor, which is the perimeter, you started getting out into, farmland. And now you go there and, I think they have an outer loop, 25 miles out. That's still, everything in between is absolutely, fully industrialized. And it's just has grown into it. And I think commerce and people have just driven that. I'm not sure if I have any more bright comments around that.
Well, let me throw this at you, because I just heard a radio program today, a podcast actually. Mm-hmm. It was a radio program that I listened to as a podcast. And the state of Oregon has just passed rent control for the whole state. And the woman from the state of Oregon, I think she was in the legislature, she said, the interviewer said, why would you pass rent control statewide when you have small markets like LaGrange and Grants Pass? And she said, because affordable housing is actually a statewide crisis. And so when you think about all the major cities talk about affordable housing and how it puts pressure on the workforce, they can't afford the housing, so you have to move farther and farther out. Businesses have trouble finding employees and keeping them. What about, do you find that affordable housing is an issue in the secondary and tertiary markets? Because I do think people talk
absolutely
Los Angeles, Boston, San Francisco, and New York, and so on.
Yeah, you're right. And it is, I mean, I travel quite a bit around the country, and you can't pick up a paper on the weekend in virtually any city and not read about some kind of, housing-related that's being written about. And, municipalities are trying to solve that by offering, bond referendums to encourage developers to bring in, new product into the marketplace. Charlotte did a bond referendum, $80 million last year. It's already been used up. Austin did one. California tried to do it and it didn't pass. I don't know what they were thinking about. But, it's across the country. Cleveland, for example, did a big downtown revitalization to bring in workforce housing for by offering tax incentives and whatnot, which is terrific. The problem with, and by the way, Oregon did that, but by the way, New York was in the news this weekend. They did the same thing. They just put a limit on how much you can increase your rents each year. I think it's now 2%. It used to be 6% a year. And the idea was to basically kind of hold the affordability in place for working families. When you put those kind of artificial controls in place, I fear that it's going to have a backlash effect, the opposite effect to what the intended result is. And the part of the problem we have about workforce housing in America is the fact we don't have enough supply to meet the need. And if you look at the cost to build, new multifamily product to meet that marketplace, it's just, it just costs more than the return you can typically get to make it pencil, unless you have some type of tax credit in place, or maybe you have you're going after some kind of subsidies or something. by putting limits where the investor, the developer, can only get a 2% per year increase, you know, they're not leaving a whole lot of hope to attract them to actually invest in that particular asset class. And I fear over the long haul, that kind of thing actually diminishes the supply, and it only exacerbates the problem that we already have across America. You know, I heard a statistic recently that said that if every home builder in America went into maximum build mode to fill the void for starter homes, they wouldn't be able to meet the demand for a decade. And, you know, we're at an all-time low since World War II as far as, you know, availability of affordable, you know, starter homes. And as a result of that, and as a result of tightening lending standards that took place, you know, ex-crisis, you know, you just have people staying in their rental properties much longer than they historically have. I mean, I'm talking about in the recent history, decades. You know, I think I saw a stat that the average working family stays in their apartment now 10 years longer than they historically would have, because they don't have the option to move up or move out as readily as they once did. Now, if you have people staying in the properties and you have a supply constraint already, the last thing you want to do is put a disincentive for developers to bring new product online. It's only going to create a problem longer term. And that is not a New York City or San Francisco issue, but they do have that problem. It is an issue that exists in, you know, in cities around America, because as the economy has done well, it's created a lot of jobs, and those people have, you know, gotten on with their life, gotten married, had kids. They, you know, need a place to live, and if they can't afford a home, they've got to rent. And I fear that some of these short-term measures that I'm sure are popular really don't consider the bigger and longer-term effects that ultimately will create a bigger issue that's already a problem.
Let's turn the clock back just a little bit and talk about the global financial crisis and the effect that mm-hmm. had on secondary and tertiary markets for two reasons. I mean, first of all, we don't believe that the next downturn is going to be something of the magnitude of a global financial crisis like that last one. I mean, there's certainly much more discipline in place now. But the media covers the big markets. It talks nationally, globally, and it covers the big markets. You really don't hear much of anything reported about secondary and tertiary markets. So how did they perform? How badly were they hurt during the global financial crisis? Because I think that might inform us a little bit as to how they'll do in just a your garden variety downturn.
Well, I mean, as you know, we bought a lot and managed a lot of real estate around the country, and much of it fell into, you know, tertiary markets. And, you know, if you look at, you know, builder properties that were building for path of growth that never came, you know, those got hurt badly. And in many cases, they haven't come back yet. Now, the positive and negative of that is, you know, the values of a lot of properties outside the Smile, you know, outside the coast and, you know, the Sun Belt, haven't roared back to the levels that I think the coast and the other markets have, and therefore, you know, there's been a much more muted recovery, and I guess in some respects that's a good thing, because a muted recovery means that the downside likely is much less expected as well. If, you know, in the event you had a nationwide kind of downturn, and so I think that in some respects, it could be viewed by some as a safer bet, because, you know, you don't have an artificial bubble being built into certain asset classes in the major markets that's really driven it beyond kind of what the economics would make sense to suggest that it's worth. But the market's awfully efficient. You know, in New York, for example, because we, you know, it's Pickle New York, you know, the market's already values are already coming off just naturally, and it's not a you know, a massive reduction, but it's reducing. We already see certain values residing, and that's a good thing. You know, a kind of a slow let out of the balloon is a lot better than a pop. And you know, when we bought assets at their, you know, at the really dark times, you know, 2009, 10, 11, and those assets that were on the coast, and we saw them return to values at their peak and go beyond that. And but in the smaller markets, it was a much slower recovery, and in some cases, we haven't even gotten back to what it was before the crash. And that's why we don't necessarily see, if you are going to have a downturn, we're not going to see the bottom drop out of the markets uniformly like it did before.
Mm.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And you know, to your point, I think it's to your point. You know, years ago, the newsroom at the Los Angeles Business Journal, where I used to work, we were meeting with, actually he owned the paper, but he's a Kansas City-based real estate developer, but he owns the LA Business Journal, a couple other business journals, a guy named Larry Bridges, and we asked, you know, how's Kansas City doing? And he said, you know, Kansas City is doing great. It keeps perking along. It doesn't get the big highs of the big markets, but we also don't get the big valleys either. So there's a steadiness there, which I think is to your point. So one more question, Pat, and I'll let you get back to hunting some deals down here. What is your outlook then for the next 3 to 5 years? Because you do agree that there's going to be a downturn. So when you look at the secondary and tertiary markets, over the next 3 to 5 years, what's your expectation?
I think there's going to be a different downturn. I mean, than anything we saw in this last cycle. It's going to be nothing like that. And I don't think it's going to be led by the banks, for example. And I think that the real estate that's going to be impacted, so I mean, again, I'm just going to talk about real estate, is going to probably be driven more by corporate over-leverage that's occurred. And as a result, the peripheral effect was going to be, real estate's going to be affected by that. And therefore, it's going to be a different kind of downturn. The real estate fundamentally is not going to drop in value because the markets necessarily drop, but it may drop in value because the corporate sponsor may have gotten in trouble, and it could affect the debt. Could affect the real estate as a result of that. So it's going to be different. I mean, so the moment I said that, so I'll probably be wrong, but that's how we're kind of viewing it. And you know, we're a major player in the multifamily space. That's where we put a lot of our attention, and we just don't see in the space that we spend a lot of time going to have the same kind of downturn that other asset classes may. And part of it is just simply supply and demand. And I'm just a big believer in that people have to live somewhere. And there's a lot more demand than supply in the smaller, I'll call it non-luxury asset classes that we deal with. And we like that from a risk-return point of view. I mean, it's kind of that comment about the Kansas City guy. It's kind of plugging along. You don't see values going through the roof overnight, but on the other hand, you don't see them dropping out because the fundamentals of cash flow and NOI is really kind of the underpinning of that real estate in the first place. And that's kind of our view. We just don't see over the next 3 to 5 years, at least in the areas that we invest, suffering a bubble popping. And I hope we're right.
Yeah, so do I, and so do a lot of people listening to this broadcast. Our guest has been Pat Jackson. He's the founder and CEO of Sabal Capital Partners. It is a diversified financial services firm specializing in commercial real estate, lending and investing. And Sabal is headquartered in Irvine, California, as we said earlier during podcast. But there are 500 other markets on the radar at Sabal. And by definition, the lion's share of those are secondary and tertiary markets. Pat, thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure. Nice chatting with you.